Thanks for listening to A Long Time in Finance with Jonathan Ford and Neil Collins, in partnership with Briefcase News, the service that brings intelligent curation and analysis to your media monitoring. Well, today we're going to talk about market delusions. And basically, a market delusion is when something important is happening with just a handful of companies that are pioneers in a field. And a narrative emerges. This industry is going to be huge and change the world. Think railways in the 19th century, radio, in the 1920s, or even the internet craze around the time of the millennium. The companies in this new industry are the dominant players and will remain so, the narrative continues. So you can't value them on conventional valuation metrics because this is going to be so massive. The dot-com bubble is a great example. You had an array of companies priced at 100 plus times earnings, and those companies were the dominant players, and some still are. Take Qualcomm. Back in 1999, it had risen more than any stock in the world. It was up over 27-fold. Since then, it has remained a dominant player in the plumbing of the internet. But how's it done as a stock? Well, you would have been twice as wealthy today investing in the S&P 500 as investing in Qualcomm at the start of 2000. Today, investors confront something which looks suspiciously like another market delusion in AI. As with the dot-com boom, the narrative is that this is going to change everything. How we buy goods, services, communicate, research, socially interact, run businesses. Some AI stocks, such as the chipmaker Nvidia, are now trading at very elevated valuations. So we thought we'd look more closely at the dot-com story. What lessons does it really hold for us about what's happening now? And we're very pleased to welcome on the show Brian McCulloch, who is a two-decade veteran of the internet industry and the founder of various web-based startups. And he's also the author of a history of the web entitled How the Internet Happened. So welcome, Brian.
Thank you for having me on the show. And I should caveat as well that I am also a venture capitalist and have an AI fund myself. So I have my toe in the AI era as well.
Okay, well, that's
that's a comfort.
Yes. I guess the first big question is whether we should think about the dot-com boom as a delusion. I mean, clearly there was a lot of froth, but a lot of big things came out of it.
I would make the argument that we don't think enough about the dot-com era as basically being a fundamental precursor for everything that's happening, not just in markets, but in society right now. I've said before that for the last 30 going on 40 years, in a way, in the West, the economics have been nothing but one bubble replacing another bubble, replacing another bubble. The dot-com bubble was the first one at least experienced by this generation of what we would call here in the States, Main Street folks, in terms of it was the first time that a lot of people were invested in the stock market, but also it was the first time that people had this experience of, wait, why did my neighbor buy a new house? It's because they were in this stock called eBay that went up 200x since they bought it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we had that before the housing bubble burst, at least in North America. There was a housing boom as well, where people were buying a house and selling it for twice its money in a year. And now you've got things like crypto. So the argument I'm making is that I feel like not just in economics, but in society, we have been trained by the last 30 years. It's not get rich quick, but it is if you're early to something and if you're smart enough to be early and get there first, you can get rich. And the dot-com bubble was, at least for our generation, you know, not going all the way back to the railroads or to even the 20s and even the boom times of the 50s and the stocks then, it was the first time for this era that people were trained on the concept of this is virgin territory, this is a brand new vista with seemingly unlimited possibility, get in first, plant your flag and get rich.
And you're right, some people did get rich, but it's interesting to look at who got rich, if you like, and from which stocks they got rich, because there were a lot of stories from the 1990s of companies that basically seemed to be going places very, very quickly, and they shot up in their IPOs and then they went bust. And it's interesting to get your take on, were there unifying features behind the companies that came through the dot-com bubble and did well, as opposed to those who flamed out in the course of it or immediately afterwards?
A key concept that started in this era a phrase you hear a lot, scale, going for scale. What that means is potentially for any product in the sort of computer or internet era, the addressable market is potentially every human being on the planet. Before the internet, that was not the case for various historical reasons. I mean, during the Cold War, half of the globe was not accessible to Western capital markets, things like that. But also, you know, before the internet, what products, the addressable market would be every human being on the planet, maybe Coca-Cola, right? But now you can have a, you know, the cliche is a 23-year-old in a dorm room dream up a chat app, and potentially within 5 years, 3-4 billion people are all using it on a daily basis. So one of the key concepts of the dot-com era was that everyone was like, this is a brand new opportunity, the likes of which we haven't seen in centuries, where the addressable market is so vast that potentially anything can be bigger than the scale of previous companies. Now, the problem is that the companies in the dot-com era were probably, for technological reasons and reasons of timing, too soon. The famous flameouts are a lot of the e-commerce players like the pets.com and things like that, or grocery delivery startups that burn through millions of dollars of capital. All of those ideas have been borne out subsequent to the dot-com bubble. The ones that flamed out in the late 90s, it's not that their ideas were wrong so much as a lot of them were just too early. But that concept of scale, that concept of in a digital world where a product can be used by anybody because everybody has equal access to it on their smartphones now, that still holds true. And I think that the dot-com era was humanity's sort of entree into this scale of the potential of markets and products.
It does rather bear out the old adage that the markets hugely overestimate the short-term impact of inventions and innovation, and underestimates the long-term impact, which we are starting to see now. As you say, these businesses were not trying to do the wrong thing. Many of them had good ideas, and you said they were just a bit too soon. I thought it was quite interesting to look at an example that Jonathan produced. Qualcomm has delivered as it was expected to, but those who bought the stock at the top of the market have done pretty badly.
I would make an argument that if we're talking about simply 90s stocks, you could have bought Nvidia back then, you could have, as you're saying, bought Qualcomm or whatever. But in terms of like, what are the top 20 market cap stocks in the world today, the only one that survived from the dot-com era is Amazon. So what we remember of the dot-com era was a lot of e-commerce players. I mentioned pets.com, but there was a dot-com for any sort of product you could imagine. The reason that that happened, again, I'm coming from a North American perspective, is this was in the era of big box retail, where you had what we call a big box store, your Best Buy, your Linens and Things, your Bed Bath and Beyond, for almost every product category that would sell at retail. And so everyone thought that that sort of model will hold over. So we will create the dot-com commerce play for pet food. We'll do it for clothes, for toys, for this, that, and the other thing. What no one anticipated was that Amazon would be all of those things. Amazon is not called the everything store for nothing. A lot of what we remember as the failures of the dot-com era are basically just the companies that were roadkill by Amazon.
The store that ate the world, I think.
Essentially, yes.
But there was a distinction, Brian, between what were called the e-commerce plays, so people who were trying to sell to consumers, and there were what were called the picks and shovels, I seem to remember, of the internet. And the idea was that the picks and shovels would be the smarter play because you had to take a bet on which piece of e-commerce might work. And some segments were a bit difficult because things like clothes back then, people wondered whether the images were good enough to get people to, and they weren't.
By the way, they were not.
Yeah. And it was too slow.
Yes.
But was there any evidence that the picks and shovels really were a better bet in the long run?
A lot of people don't know this, but there were actually two concurrent bubbles. There's the dot-com bubble that we're thinking of. So we're thinking of consumer-facing brands and companies like that. But there was also, as you're saying, the infrastructure bubble around things like Qualcomm, Global Crossing. There were companies that were trying to do internet from space at the time that, you know, flamed out. And, you know, again, another idea that is now common. What happened was, is that sort of picks and shovels play that blew up, not because there was anything wrong with the business model. It was more that, again, it was too soon and there was oversupply and overcapacity. And so then when all of the commercial facing players went under, when the dot-com bubble burst, all of their clientele goes away. And you have essentially, and you mentioned the railroads earlier, there's a direct parallel between the railroad boom in Britain in, what is it, the 1840s and 50s, and how it's so speculative that they overbuilt. But to this day, that's still the railways and stock that Britain uses and has been using for the last 150 years and more. And the same thing happened when, so the dot-com bubble bursts. All of these infrastructure plays that are, you know, laying fiber all around the globe, they, a lot of them, Sprint was a huge one that blew up here in the United States. Global Crossing, I mentioned again. Iridium was a satellite play that blew up. Like the railroads, even though those companies blew up, all of the fiber had been laid. So you have this sort of dark capacity that now, when the dot-com bubble bursts, it's not like they pulled up the cables. Now all of that infrastructure is available for 5 cents on the dollar. So the argument would be the reason that the Googles and Facebooks and Amazon, at least with AWS, were able to then rise out of the ashes in the early 2000s was because all of that overcapacity, all of that overbuilding was there for them on the cheap to do the things that made it possible to economically deliver cloud computing, to do social networking, because it was all there. It was all financially much cheaper to have that sort of infrastructure. So the question you asked me was that a better play for the investor? Probably not. I'm here to tell you that if you bought and hold a stock in 1998, unless that stock was Amazon, your best bet was you made your money back, but a lot of stuff blew up. It wasn't until the blow up happens that you get the companies that come in that are making just gobs and gobs of money.
Okay, so I just want to leap in and ask you where Apple fits into the dot-com story. It's not what you'd conventionally say, as was it ever a dot-com stock?
No, it was not there. It was not there at all. So in 1997, I believe it was, there was a famous Wired magazine cover story that had an Apple logo with sort of like a crown of thorns around it. And the headline was Pray, because people believed that Apple was maybe 6 months away from going bankrupt. Steve Jobs comes back in 97. The Apple that we know, the turnaround sort of began in the late 90s when they come out with the iMac. And what is the iMac? The I was meant to be an internet computer.
Yep.
But Apple had such small market share that they were basically an afterthought for everybody in the industry and for consumers. It's not until really the iPod, which was released in 2001, that they became the tech juggernaut that we know today.
And the secret being what? I've always thought the secret of Apple was they got everyone's credit card details.
This will sound like a glib answer, but the secret was the genius of Steve Jobs. Apple was a company that Michael Dell famously said that they should shut Apple down and return the money to investors before Steve Jobs came back. When they come out with the iPod, that is their first hit where it's like, we can sell devices to the tune of hundreds of millions of devices per year. This is in a pre-smartphone era. Now, you know, we're used to, you know, a billion, I think it's 1.2 billion smartphones were shipped last year. This comes back to the concept of scale. If you can sell a hardware device that will ship 1.2 billion units reliably year in and year out, you'd have to be completely stupid not to be able to make money at that level of scale.
The one company we haven't mentioned, which I would really be interested in your views on, is, of course, Microsoft, which you'd have thought would have gone the way of IBM, say, but it has managed to reinvent itself in an extraordinary way and keep on top of its market, or the market, in a way that has defied most people's predictions. What do you think was behind that?
If we were doing this interview in 2008, I would have told you that Microsoft is the IBM of the modern era, sort of like the sleeping dinosaur that is no longer relevant. I would argue that the whole first decade of this century, they were basically irrelevant. What they did to turn themselves around, and again, I'm going to give credit to one person for this, is Satya Nadella, his predecessor, Steve Ballmer, who took over from Bill Gates. I would argue that what Steve Ballmer forgot was that Microsoft was in the compute business, not the Windows business. Steve Ballmer thought that Windows was everything. He almost contradicted what I was saying a few minutes ago. He believed that Microsoft was a consumer play, but what Satya Nadella did was understand that what Microsoft is good at is providing compute power to anybody, and they started to be able to provide that. They leaned into providing that for enterprise. In a way, Microsoft was always primarily an enterprise company, but by positioning themselves after the internet comes back, after all of that dark fiber, as we talked about, starts to get bought up, providing compute via the cloud, via the internet to enterprise is the sort of the next wave that they caught and are continuing to ride today. So, you know, Amazon did this with AWS, but Microsoft, basically, you can still get Windows on your computer. You can still get Outlook email or whatever. But primarily, they make their money by what we think of as those data centers, providing compute infrastructure to consumers, but also primarily to enterprises. And as that has taken over everything, they continue to ride that wave because that's what's happening with AI now. In the future, the AI should be operating on your phone, on device. But primarily right now, all of the action that we're seeing in AI development is happening via a cloud service. When I'm using ChatGPT, my requests are going to a data center that Microsoft owns. And that is where the sort of AI magic is happening. So they turn themselves around by catching the wave of the future, which is sort of compute as a service, SaaS.
You touch on a very important point, I think, which is, you know, we teed up this discussion by talking about AI as if it was a new dot-com bubble. But of course, a lot of the companies that came out of the dot-com boom were new companies that created themselves around the new technology that emerged. To what extent is that true with AI, do you think? Or do you think that the same companies which have emerged as the winners from the dot-com era and the internet will also, you know, essentially the same people who will, if there is a pot of gold at the end of AI, will be the people who seize it?
I can speak to this from an investor in the AI space. You know, one of the thoughts was, okay, this will be the same playbook as we've seen a couple times before. Disruption from below, the incumbents will move too slowly to catch the wave. And so we want to pick the Google of the AI era, the Facebook of the AI era. But in the same way that, like I said, we've had 30 years of bubbles and we've trained people to be like, well, what's the next big thing? Can I get in early? The corporate world has learned that lesson as well. And so as an investor, I have been surprised by the degree to which 2 years ago, I would have said, well, it's not like Ford Motor Company or your bank is going to be investing in AI. They're going to have other people do that. No, that's not true. Everybody is tinkering with AI because, like I said, they've learned the lesson of the last 30 years. They don't want to be disrupted. So I would say that this is very early. You know, it's not even been 2 years that ChatGPT was released. Right now, it seems like the incumbents are still holding all the cards. Google, Facebook, Microsoft, everybody is making huge AI bets, huge AI plays. So as of the early innings of this game, the disruption is not coming from below in the classic Clay Christensen sense. I don't know that that'll hold to be true. As an investor, I don't believe it would be true because otherwise game is up and I should return the money to the LPs right now because either OpenAI or Microsoft or Facebook is going to win.
One of the lessons that I remember through the dot-com boom was that quite sensible investors were throwing out conventional companies to make the capital to plunge into the next big thing. And conventional companies fell to ridiculous multiples because basically nobody wanted them. Then, of course, the boom turned to bust and suddenly these unwanted signets turned out to be rather attractive swans. And I wonder whether the same thing will happen this time.
I feel like it's a rising tide lifting all boats right now. That was true in the 90s as well. There are famous stories of like a random company would announce that it was launching a website or that it had a new internet division and their stock would go up 300% in a day. You do see a halo, at least for some of the companies that I follow right now, for, you know, if you're a Salesforce, say, and have been adding all of these generative AI bells and whistles to your existing product. I feel like we're, at least from the perspectives of the markets, at a point where investors are feeling like this is only additive to the companies that are already the winners. Because as you can see, like what Microsoft is doing and what folks like Salesforce are doing is when you add these AI bells and whistles, then you add a higher tier of your subscription. You know, so if I'm already paying Microsoft, I don't know, $30 per seat for use of your Microsoft Office or whatever. Oh, but by the way, for an additional $30, you can get all of these AI co-pilots as well that will make your dealing with Microsoft Excel and writing spreadsheets this much easier and this much faster or whatever. So I feel like, again, this is early days of this new era of the AI era. Investors feel like this is not disruptive in the sense that someone is going to come from behind and kill Salesforce so much as Salesforce can add, and I'm sorry, I'm using them as one particular example, can add AI to their successful products and make them more attractive and charge more for them.
Brian, are you an investor in Salesforce?
I am not.
You now want to tell us.
I don't have a single share of Salesforce. Yeah.
You said earlier that everyone's got the get rich quick vibe. Companies are doing it. Individual investors quite happy now to buy companies with zero revenue or zero profits and even not much revenue, but just a great idea. Do you think that the markets are any smarter than they were in 1999?
You all probably are more familiar with famous sayings about how the markets are never any smarter. You just have to wait for each generation to relearn the lessons or the bad habits of the previous generation. Having said that, if you look at a long enough time scale, like look at every market, at least in the Western world for the last 50 years, and you know, it's higher, every single GDP, the level of wealth, you know, of median individuals, like I don't think that there's any way that we can argue against the fact that technology has made the planet wealthier and more efficient. I do not see anything that will reverse that trend. And then if I'm feeling bullish, potentially AI is just a new flavor of the thing that will continue to sort of fuel the upwards and to the right sort of growth that we've experienced for the last 30, 40 years.
What do you think, if you look ahead with your investor's hat on, would you say are the biggest risks to the AI story?
Societal risks are obviously the robots take over the world and enslave us all. Also destroying democracy in the sense that you don't know what is real and what is fake. And so there is no truth. I am not in any way minimizing those as potentially negative events. But the AI that we have now is only possible because it was trained on the internet. Almost like a biological impulse. We've spent the last 30 years taking all of humanity's collective knowledge, putting it online and publicly publishing it, which allowed the AI companies to scrape the entire internet. When they talk about training AI models on data, they are training it on our websites, our comments on YouTube, our postings on Reddit. One of the biggest structural threats to AI that could literally bring this all to a screeching halt is now that AI is able to generate content, the web could be filled with AI garbage. So then how would you train an AI model of the future to be better if their training sets have been filled with garbage? AI itself could potentially prevent future AI from getting better because it's taken over the internet.
I think this is literally a rubbish in, rubbish out doomsday machine.
Well, I was going to say, you know, it's been brought up on fillet steak and fine dining, and the danger is that what they'll be doing is eating rubbish from then on, which they'll be regurgitating.
Right. One of the things that the AI companies are trying to do is we've scraped the entire internet, so now where do we go to get high quality data? They're cutting deals with the Associated Press and the New York Times and whatever, because then companies that have this huge corpus of high quality data, they can feed into the models. But once you run through that, where do you go? Like, so potentially there might not be enough good data for the next near term to improve AI much beyond where it is right now. And if that were to happen, then that would sort of bring a screeching halt to what feels like this sort of revolution that's a rocket ship.
Well, that would be true, especially if, of course, the newspapers can no longer pay the poor old bloody journalists.
Exactly. Yeah. If there's, and also, so
hey, but there are podcasts.
Exactly.
I mean, I just got one question. Just, I know it's a very unfair question, but we talked about earlier about Amazon being the one great success story from the internet era. What's the Amazon of the AI era? Do you think we can see what it is now?
We don't know yet. The leading player right now is OpenAI. They're way ahead of the game, but there's people that are right shoulder to shoulder with them. Anthropic is one. Echoes of the dot-com era. There is a nine-month-old startup based in Paris called Mistral AI, which just last week released their latest model, which is apparently shot to the top of the leaderboards, is potentially better than OpenAI and certain measurements and things like that. It's the dot-com bubble all over again. A nine-month-old company and based in Paris, so like not Silicon Valley or whatever, could potentially be the leader. That somebody could release a new model tomorrow that will blow OpenAI out of the water. It's a fascinating time, and there's no way I could pick a winner right now.
Well, perhaps we shall come back to you and twist your arm to pick one.
Well, maybe you should ask ChatGPT.
That was A Long Time in Finance with Jonathan Ford and Neil Collins. Production and editing by Nick Hilton, and our sponsorship partner is Briefcase.news. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review it on your podcast app, as that will help new listeners find us.